one of the most uplifting shows on radio, No Glass Ceiling, introduces women in business who do just that, run their business, and women in business roles that once were taboo. Join me now for No Glass Ceiling on Business Radio X. And here we go again with another No Glass Ceiling on Tucson Business Radio with Mark Bishop. Of course, we are part of the BRX member network across America, and we deal with business, small, large, medium, doesn't matter. Our objective is into the community and to help where we can. We've done a little slightly different show today, or going to be doing a slightly different show, and where we're touching on not-for-profits, because they are a marvelous concern in our community in reference to fighting to always get funds and fighting to do wonderful jobs. So we thought we'd have a little bit of a break away from the traditional, and we've still got three lovely ladies, and we've still got three women who run top jobs, because that's what it's about. No glass ceiling. They broke right through it. Or they're doing jobs with, you know, traditionally were taboo because they were men-held jobs. Not anymore, and not these days. And I'm very proud to welcome, first of all, Jennifer Schoengert.
Hello.
Thank you. Jennifer, welcome.
Good.
Jennifer is president of the Nourish Board of Directors and has served on the board since 2014. I'm going to find out all about Nourish, because I didn't know much at all when I first looked at this particular not-for-profit. The big one that we do know of is Casa de los Niños, and we have Susie Hewn. Hello, Susie.
Hi.
And she is the... Well, you're the CEO, Chief Executive Officer, and but you do program development, strategic planning, and finance. Another lady that wears seven hats. Guys can't do this sort of thing, but women do. Don't they, T. Van Hook?
I do.
T. has been around for a long time, and she runs a fantastic organization called the CEO. Well, she's CEO for Tucson Habitat for Humanity. And wouldn't it be wonderful if it was a world where everyone had a decent place to live?
It would.
And my guess on No Glass Ceiling this episode is a lady who may be not the whole world, but a darn good slice of it here in Tucson. You're just trying to achieve that, aren't you?
We are. We're working hard to make sure everyone has a decent place to live. I think the four of us are here because we had a good place to stay last night.
And mm-hmm.
If everyone did, I think the world would be a better place.
Well, welcome to the CEO of Habitat for Humanity. You've been doing this for some time.
Well, I've been CEO for over 4 years, but I was a volunteer for 14 before that, and I've been in the same business realm for a long time, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Creating a more compassionate and just world, Habitat for Humanity Tucson brings people together. What do? They build homes. But they also build communities, and they build a lot of hope. And where are you today with all of that, T?
Well, we're doing quite a bit. I think we have, right now we have about 12 or 13 homes under construction, but we're getting ready for World Habitat Day, which is October 1st. And then on October 5th, it's a Friday, we'll be raising the walls on six new houses, and 2 weeks later on four more.
Wow.
So we're really excited about what's going on, and we'll be doing some nine two-story homes this year, and we have a lot of families we're serving. A big thing that we've been doing, and I think a lot of people aren't aware of, and Mark, I know you are, but we're doing home rehabs. Mm-hmm. We're doing a lot of repair jobs in the community. Tens of thousands of older Tucsonans live in homes that are in desperate need of repair. And if we can keep seniors in their homes, their longevity expands by 2/3. If we remove a senior from their home because they need a major home repair, according to the Centers for Disease Control, their life expectancy is cut by 2/3.
Wow.
So just like Susie does with the kids at Casa de los Niños, we're trying to keep elderly, disabled, and our veterans in their homes so they can age in place, and it's really critical to us.
Your website states, T, that no matter who we are or where we come from, we all deserve to have a decent life. We deserve to feel strength and stability day after day. We deserve to know that we have the power to take care of ourselves and build our own futures. Is that what drives you every day?
I think it is. We like to say it's more than a matter of conscience, it's a matter of action. And every day I feel like we need to put what we believe into work, and I do that through home building. I build sometimes.
Are you a builder by trade?
I'm not a builder by trade, but I certainly know building, planning, and I can read a Blueprint or two and community action. But I've done something with homes or the homeless. Most of my career, I started out over 30 years ago with HIV/AIDS and working with folks who were infected with that during the AIDS epidemic. And now I'm doing these types of services, and it just feels really great.
You're certainly a compassionate person, aren't you? I mean, you'd be lost if you weren't working in this realm somewhere along the line.
Well, somewhere. No. I think it's really critical. I think the critical thing you said, though, is that we bring people together. I think it's community change that Habitat is about. We're about breaking a cycle of poverty. And the way we know how to do that is by putting people in a home. Most Americans build wealth through their home.
Mm-hmm.
And so we offer extremely low-income mortgages. We don't give houses away. People build the houses, mm-hmm. build sweat equity, and then they have a mortgage. So Habitat's
not... Yeah, it's a pretty cool deal. We're going to go right into that a little bit later on.
Okay.
But I did see something the other night on documentary. So sad. It was a woman with three children living out of a car.
Oh.
And I don't know how. I just don't know how. I mean, I thank the Lord every night I go to bed. I can tell you what you're doing is wonderful.
I've always...
It just brings tears to my eyes. Let's talk to Susie Hune. She's a top chief executive officer of a wonderful organization for the little ones. You've had over 30 years of experience in the child welfare, early childhood, behavioral health, and family support fields, including 16 years at senior management level. What was it, do you think, that brought you to this type of calling?
Oh, total happenstance. Walked out of college with a degree and said, now what do I do? And happened to have done a volunteer stint. I think volunteering really led me. I was a big sister to a little girl who was in foster care. So Stephanie was 8. She was born into the state system. She mm-hmm. was given up at birth. She was blind. She was deaf. She was treated like she had no capabilities whatsoever.
Oh, poor thing.
Was warehoused and institutionalized back then when we had institutions for mm-hmm. our children. Luckily, we don't anymore. We know better and we do better for kids today. But after working with her for almost a year, just in socialization skills, she was in a terrific foster care home and being cared for. But she had lost already 8 years of her life, which is critical for a young child because that's the ability you have to really
right.
form their brain and get them off to a good start. So what I learned from that experience at the end of that was I live in one of the richest countries in the world. And if this is how we treat our children, we mm. have got to be able to do better. So I've spent the last 39 years one child, one family at a time, mm-hmm. trying to do better by our kids.
And a wonderful job you do. Your bio actually states that you're well-versed in effective organizational management of a child welfare agency. There's staff coaching involved, professional advancement, program development and implementation, the community needs assessment, community family, child-based support services, and state and federal child welfare legislation. That'd be a nightmare. And public policy. Which of those do you call on most?
Well, I think to actually have systems changes and community changes, you have to not only advocate for your families and children you serve and your cause, but you have to help teach families to advocate for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do believe that advocacy is one of the greatest skills we can give people so that they can speak up for themselves and fight for their own needs, because we're not always going to be there.
No.
And so how do we make families have the skills and the toolkit they need to raise healthy kids and live in a vibrant community?
Mm.
And that's what we're all about. And we come at it from a lot of different ways because there's no one answer.
No.
Housing's critical. Food insecurity. We really struggle with child poverty rates in our own community. Pima County is one of the worst in the state.
Yes. It's sad, isn't it?
How do we kind of manage some very complex needs and at the same time trying to address their mental illness, trying to address child abuse, trying to address a lot of trauma that has happened to our children and families along the way. So it's been a tough road for many of our families. And the beauty of it is, though, is to see when they come together and take those skills, take that education, put it to use, and start to move forward in a positive way.
Very much so. So what is a service continuum? What does that mean?
So we serve everything from birth to through adults. And so when we talk about a continuum, I like to think about kind of three buckets. One is really primary prevention. You know, in my dream world with my magic wand, I would send every new mom home with a home visitor. Mm-hmm. And she may need one visit after she had her child because she's got great support. She's right. knowledgeable. She's got, you know, good system in her own community. Or she may need years of family support to be able to mitigate past trauma, past abuse, or get out of some tough relationships and really has no clue what she's doing going forward as a mother. So I think that prevention is key to everything, and that's why we have expanded. And at CASA, we recently are going to be expanding in January and opening a new early education center, high-quality child care for birth to five mm-hmm. that is often not accessible to low-income families.
Well, that's wonderful.
So we're really excited about that change.
I didn't ask you how much sort of money that would involve. But
it's a bit.
It's a bit. And you get it out of them, don't you? You find a way.
We still raise considerable amounts.
And that's where the community
privately,
is
wonderful,
too.
And that support allows us to
do stuff. You have good regular private
sponsors,
don't you?
We do, but there's also more competition. Dune County has got a lot of nonprofits.
Is there ever? I think it's 3,215 or something like that.
And over 500 are health and human service providers.
Really? There you go. Jennifer?
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Nourish. Now, I got to admit, albeit not good, that I really didn't know much about this organization. How long have you been? Anyway, it's an organization that supports families who receive therapy for feeding challenges.
Correct.
Now, does that really explain it properly?
Yeah. So we're, you know, relative to Habitat for Humanity and Casa de los Niños, we're probably the newcomers to the scene. We've been around, Nourish has been around as a local nonprofit for about 8 years. And the focus and the mission of Nourish is to provide children and families with, to provide family and community support for children who have feeding challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of,
How did you get involved with this organization? Why this one instead of one of the others?
Sure.
3,000.
I know. There are a lot of great nonprofits in Tucson some great missions and causes. For me, this was really personal. I'm a parent of a child who had some feeding issues right from birth,
mm-hmm.
Was born and was in the NICU for a couple of weeks, and then came home, and we had a lot of difficulty just getting him to be able to eat. As a parent, you don't really ever think of that when you have a child. You think that comes naturally,
happen.
Right? It's normal. Mm. And so when you bring your baby home, you think, you know, you're going to love it and care for it and feed it. And you don't ever think that the baby might not know how to eat or might have problems with stamina or energy or coordination to breathe when they're trying to.
That'd be frightening.
It is frightening, yes.
You don't know. What do you do? I mean, if the little one doesn't eat.
Right. Which is, you know, very basic thing, just like housing and safe.
Stuff we take for granted.
Exactly.
You know.
Things we take for granted. So it's really difficult on parents and children because they don't know what to do. Parents don't know where to go and who to ask for help. And a lot of times it can be very isolating because parents sometimes think they're the only ones who are dealing with this. But there are some really incredible therapists in Tucson that work with families and children who have these challenges due to a medical reason. Or, you know, being premature, having heart problems, different kinds of things. And those therapists are very highly skilled and trained, especially in things like occupational therapy, feeding therapy, have special training in that to work with children for a length of time. I know for in our case, it took actually years really to get our son to the point where he was able to eat sort of a regular diet. So,
well, you now understand firsthand, don't you, the emotional mm-hmm. and physical stress
yes.
that parents undergo. I mean, think about it, just learning to swallow,
correct,
chew,
correct,
or drink from a straw.
Correct, yes.
You know, some basic to simple, mm-hmm. you know. Okay, so you now work on behalf of Nourish to develop awareness in the community and to grow Nourish's Feeding Therapy Scholarship Fund.
Correct.
Okay, what's that all about?
So Nourish is actually a pretty focused and small organization. We have a very dedicated board, and the fundraising that we do goes directly to providing feeding scholarships. So those go to families and children where therapy is needed, and evaluation is needed by a dietitian or a pediatric therapist, either speech or occupational. And the insurance either doesn't cover those services or it only covers a portion of those therapy services. So there are a lot of families that need some financial support in order to get those therapies. And we know, and I know from personal experience, that they can be literally life-saving, teaching children and families how to have these skills to be able to enjoy mealtimes. So this is really...
it's sad, isn't it?
It is. It's really difficult.
It's heart-wrenching stuff. I mean, I don't know, Susie, I tell you.
Yeah, there's a lot
of You know what? I mean, I just feel for you guys out there in the jungle. Everybody's pulling at you for money, or everybody's pulling at everybody for money one way or another. Your cause is incredibly important. And then Susie's cause with the little ones. And then the Habitat, for God's sake. So people say, well, who the hell do I give to? I can't give everybody. And it becomes very competitive.
Correct, yes.
So
yes.
From that standpoint, you must get terribly frustrated.
You know, I want to say this, that I think I can share this, that we want donors to give where their heart is. Mm-hmm. So there isn't really... I don't feel frustrated because I think it's a gift for us to share our story. I think we are working hard to share our story and we're appreciative of donors. I think we get frustrated when there's some confusion. There was a change in the tax law a couple of weeks ago and it happened snap. You know,
There was no lead-in.
We get some news that there's going to be an administrative directive on Wednesday or Thursday.
The and directive it's not even final.
It's right.
So now it's just we're making it up as we go.
It's just kind of floating out there. This panic comes, and you know the stuff is floating around.
Can we share that? Talk about some of that. What's
sure,
the stuff
absolutely.
Floating around?
Well,
no tax. No relief.
Well, Arizona has a tax credit for people who qualify, and there are qualifying organizations, and there's a number of categories, schools and people who help the working poor and a variety of categories. And many people take a direct tax credit for giving to these organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And then
of which they're entitled to.
Of which they're entitled to. And it's a great thing, and I think we all share in the idea that we'd love for people to be able to direct their money, direct to something they're passionate about, something they care about. You know, I'm listening to the story, and our grandson was born and unable to eat regularly, and it was very isolating. And we've had Habitat home buyers who are born with children with disabilities, and the reason they can't own a home is because they've been struggling with medical bills and other things. So we're really all interrelated in that we're serving community. And then you get this notice, and throughout the nonprofit community where, you know, donors need to make a donation by this critical date or they're going to lose their opportunity. But we're really in a year where we know the IRS code is changing the minimum deduction for the single deduction, the deduction for couples. We don't know how many people are going to itemize and take a charitable donation. We really don't have a litmus test on who's giving it from their heart. Are people giving just for a tax credit? Does the tax credit in Arizona just give you a convenient amount to know what to write a check for, a target? So I think that donors get confused by misleading news, by things that are floating out there.
You know what? It almost sounds like it to me, T, that you guys need a town hall just about, right? A town hall, a big night on... No, but these issues are critical.
I think they're very critical.
And
I'm just
all
laughing.
The donors go along and learn stuff.
Because
but
I
have
sit
a
on,
government representative as well.
I sit on Arizona Town Hall, which is another organization for civil discourse within the state that tackles big statewide issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I think statewide we need a... There are a lot of issues we could be all talking about civilly. And I think we do get together and collaborate and cooperate on a lot of giving issues. I think the frustration is in our being able to provide timely, accurate information to our donors. All we're trying to do is share our story. And we know that the donors out there, they want to connect. People want to give. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, who are associated with Habitat, celebrated their 35th anniversary of building this past week. And Rosalind said something just lovely, Mrs. Carter did. She said, everyone wants to help. There are very few people out there that don't want to help. But it's so overwhelming with things coming at them. You know, give to this charity, television commercials with puppies and babies and music playing.
This is what I was saying. It's terribly difficult. In fact, it's stressful. For the donor, you know
you
that?
You don't know what you want to do. We just need to give them an easy way to say, this is what my heart's saying. I want an easy way to say, this is what my heart says. This is what I want to give to.
And I think it would be nice maybe if a representative of the IRS came out and went to people and had meetings a couple of months before any changes happen like that.
So a lot of this is federally driven. So a lot of the changes we're going to face in the next year are really federally driven by the tax code changes, who can itemize, who won't itemize, and if they don't itemize, will they still give to the same level? And so what was affecting it was if you took a state tax credit, which our state has many, and is very generous with. But there's also a downside to that we have to understand. We take advantage and have had great few years with great tax credits, but there's also a fiscal downside from a state budget over time because some of those tax credits are pay it forward. And there's a cliff that could come financially for our state about not being able to. And especially for a state who hasn't historically really invested, I think, in the well-being of their citizens. You know, we're good about supporting business and corporate tax cuts and trying that, but we don't put a lot of state general funds. Most of our funding comes through federal means. We don't put a lot of our state into education. We haven't upped the child care subsidy since 2000.
Time. You understand all that. I mean, you were responsible for initiating the community's first infant and toddler mental health clinic, which was a big coup. Subsequently, you launched a public behavioral health network, integrating child welfare practice and trauma, informed care focused on the special needs of children in the foster care system. You'd be very proud of that initiative.
So what we saw, actually, it's interesting because when I think about what Nourish does, we did a lot of that in our crisis shelter. We cared for medically fragile kids for so many years. And what we saw there in kids that had failure to thrive and that really were struggling, we brought in OTPT teams to work with those kids. But being in a shelter was not the best place for them to be raised. Kids need to be in a home. They can't be in their own home. I believe they still need to be in a home is a better environment for them. But from that and what we saw from kids, especially coming into the foster care system, babies is people say, oh, they don't remember, they don't know what happened to them. Yes, they do. Their brain is affected by it. Mm-hmm. The minute they're removed from their parents, they're removed from their home, their brain changes size. It also changes shape. It changes how they react to things for the rest of their life unless we intervene. Most people thought we were kind of nuts at first, saying, well, what's infant mental health? Are you going to lay an infant, you know, and have a talk session? So we did a lot of sensory integration work, a lot of the other kind of work that it took a lot to educate our community about the importance of that. And the earlier you intervene, the better your outcomes.
Totally. The professional affiliations, this is you, or is this, Casa Nino says, the group professional of the Prevent Child Abuse Arizona?
I sit on that board.
You sit on that board as well?
I do.
Welfare League of America?
I am involved with Child Welfare League.
The Association for Fundraising Professionals. Well, that's a natural one you'd be in. Arizona Council of Human Service Providers.
It's a trade association. I chair their advocacy committee. And then now I sit on the National Council of Behavioral Health and Addictions.
Okay. What about the Children's Action Alliance? What is that?
So Children's Action Alliance is a great advocacy organization in Arizona throughout the state that really focuses on children's issues from a legislative standpoint. So they're not a nonprofit. They actually are very forward in their lobbying efforts and advocacy work, but all around kids' issues.
And, of course, the National Council of Behavioral Health. Man, do you ever sleep?
Yeah, quite well.
Oh, and I could go through the 14 pages of all your board positions and God knows what else.
That just happens because you're in the business for 39 years.
Unbelievable. Were you ever approached to run for politics?
It's funny you ask that.
No, it's not.
I have been asked, would I
had
be
a feeling,
interested
I think you'd be
to
very
do
good.
That? Mm. And I've always said no.
And the main reason, family or?
I think for a lot of it, family, but I don't know that I would get the satisfaction out of that.
Nothing like you're doing
that
now.
I get out of the
you'd
work I do.
You'd have to move mountains and the whole damn Senate to be able to raise an extra $50 million for all your causes. That would be the only thing you would enjoy. Tell you what, your websites, we talked about that, T. You offer an innovative solution at Habitat, Tucson. The crisis of affordable housing. I get frustrated when I'm driving around. I see these dirty, empty blocks of land everywhere. Nothing ever happening on them. Not all privately owned, I might add. Mm-hmm. And the stuff you can build today with little igloo-type homes or... Look, there's all sorts you could build and do and put people in housing. But... never seems to happen.
So we are hosting, I don't know if you know this, but we're hosting on October 2nd. The Federal Reserve is coming, and we have some guests coming from across the country to discuss some alternative housing types. We're not talking tiny houses, but we're talking some rapid opportunities to do some infill in local lots. And so we have my friend Dan Rosenblatt from Charlottesville is coming. We have some other guest speakers coming from around the country. The Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, IDA of Tucson and Pima County are helping us pay to bring some folks in and talk about that. I have a few little ideas in my pocket that I've been pushing around for the last few years. And as housing gets harder and harder, housing lots get harder and harder to find, I think it's time for an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Another big issue we have is we have these small mobile home parks where people own their mobile homes and...
or don't. And have substandard landlords.
And have sub... thank you very much. And have substandard living conditions. And so... a lot of times that land is valuable and people will inherit the land. You know, maybe their parents have had people on that land. We're talking 6, 8, 10 mobile homes on a small strip of land. They inherit it and they'll give people who have lived there 30, 35 years, 30 days notice. That's all that's required by law in Arizona. We're really looking at some innovative projects that would allow us with a new housing type on a slab
house that we build, that we can build economically and quickly, meeting all of our energy, safety, and construction standards to maybe replace some of those houses on a smaller footprint and do what we call an asset transfer, have a mechanism for selling those houses. Another idea is we have some large lot parcels in the center part of Tucson, where people are literally built on half acres in some of our neighborhoods that had alleys back in the 50s. There may be a way that we could build granny flats. They're doing it in Denver. People could finance through a special mechanism, finance, do the interior fix-up that they need to live out their lives, fix up the bathrooms, do all of those changes. With the financing, also build a granny flat. The rent on the granny flat that would be managed by a separate organization that could vet the college student, another elderly person that lived in the smaller footprint house, that rent could pay the mortgage payment on both structures. I call it the Uber for the backyard. You have another housing unit.
I come from a country that's big on granny flats.
Absolutely.
You got your mom. You don't want to stick her into a home. You'd like her to be around so she's down past the clothesline and the dunny.
Absolutely.
It's not that bad. But what I'm saying is, look, you've got the room. Use it.
So we're looking at, and we're really happy that the city of Tucson, Pima County, and now we're talking to Cochise County, and some of the communities in Cochise County are really willing to work with us and look at some alternatives that'll be lower cost and some alternative funding mechanism. And that's why getting the Federal Reserve is important here. And we're really excited about that. I'm glad to see some of the housing ideas that are being floated.
Well, that'll be fascinating. I'd love to meet all these dudes. Maybe we can have them as a guest on Business Radio X, talking all about the various types of housing. And I like that sort of thing. I once was involved in designing a house that actually extended, and it was very private. You had to go through like a bank door just about, but there was a separate place at the back of the house. I mean, if you just use your brains a little bit, you could still have the privacy of the single family home, but you can have attached the other, and that can be used for rental, it can be used for mom, it can be used for family members, autistic children, whatever, you know, people who want their own space. Is Habitat for Humanity a Christian organization?
It is. We started and we were incorporated as a faith-based organization, but we embrace all faiths and non-faiths, so we have really expanded to really include everyone.
Fair enough. And you have an open door policy.
Absolutely.
All who desire to be part of the work are welcome. Speaking of that, what do you need most of?
Well, you know, we need land. We need cash. And we always need labor. We don't build houses. We bring people together to build houses, and that's really critical to us.
But that's what I mean. Are you still getting enough volunteers who are tradespeople, people that can do this?
We need trades, and trades are hard to come by these days with the building boom, so we need the trades. Retired trades are great. You know, if we get folks out there that can do plumbing and electrical, it's huge for us. Drywallers are a premium. I'll buy you lunch. We really could use the trades out there. But I also want to remind people, we run a very complex business model. We are a mortgage company. We're the land developer. We're the builder. So we're all of those things.
Yes.
And we could use professionals. If you're a retired, you know, mortgage banker, if you're
your skills, yes, my word.
Any of those things, we could use you in the office just as much.
What do you think of the idea of using nonviolent inmates?
We use them all the time.
You do?
We do. We have Department of Corrections crews out and working with us, probably 20 days a month, and we think it's a really great program.
Do they love it? Do they enjoy it?
They love coming out. It's a privilege for them to come out, so they're, you know, there's officers with them. Every one of our staff is trained on the protocols to be with them and supervise them. We take it very seriously. Our volunteers that are out, that are supervisors on the site, that are with us on a regular basis, I'd say 45 or 50 of our volunteers are trained to interact with the Department of Corrections crews. We call them the Men in Orange, and they do a tremendous amount of work for us, and they're learning a trade, or those who have known the trade, we put them to work in the trade so that they have
have the skills when they transition out. Yeah. It's a win-win for everyone.
It's a win-win, see? That's a little bit of good thinking, isn't it? What could you do with Jennifer? How can Nourish look for new ways to get the support that you need to do? Everybody always needs the money. We know that.
Yeah.
But who could volunteer more to do what?
It's a great question, and I think, you know, we're all talking about basic needs here, and we're all talking about worthy causes, and it's true that we really want donors who connect with us to give what they feel is right for them and where their heart leads them to give. We're really no different in the sense that, you know, we feel strongly about our mission and feel strongly about the families that we serve, and are always looking for ways to bring in new donors and bring in volunteers.
Well, how do they know now, a new mom, how does she know what you can offer? Do you go to hospitals?
We do. So one of the things we do is do in-service trainings for professionals. We do lunch and learn kind of things so that they can come and learn a little bit more about feeding issues. You'd be surprised. It's really not very well known or understood even by medical professionals. I would say that, you know, it's still something that really has to be looked into by a specialist. If there's a need identified by like a pediatrician, that they get the right kind of evaluation and expert to look at the child and really evaluate what needs are there. It's a big part of it is awareness and getting the word out in the community. A lot of our things will overlap with other medical areas. And so working with hospitals and doctor's offices and therapists and providers in the state system.
A lot of it's word of mouth.
A lot of it's word of mouth.
You wouldn't even have the money, would you, to be able to print beautiful brochures and all of that?
Right.
Because, I mean, it costs.
We try, but yeah it is. I mean, it is. Those kinds of things are costly. And so we really try to focus our funding on the direct service part of it
as much as we can. Are you a very big organization? I mean,
no,
staff-wise?
No, we're small. We're very small.
There's you and you and you.
No. No.
The three of you are very busy, aren't you?
We do. We're fortunate we do have a very dedicated board, and which does include medical professionals, therapists, you know, kind of from all areas of professions in Tucson, and also parents such as myself.
Mm-hmm.
So we put together, you know, we work really on, we focus our efforts, and we have an annual event every year that's a big fundraiser for us. It's coming up actually in October, Taste for Nourish at the Fox Theater.
And what would that entail? What's involved? Taste for Nourish.
So it's an event where we have some really great entertainment. We have really yummy appetizers. And desserts, and just really it's a nice evening to get together and celebrate the joy of food and the joy of enjoying that social time and community and recognizing that some of these feeding issues need some attention and need some support.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that every year at the Fox Theater.
And what sort of guests? We're talking, what is it, like a variety night, is it?
This year we are doing sort of a variety.
Yeah.
In the past we've done short films that have all been food theme related, so that's been something that we've tried to bring out some of those creative aspects that focus on the joy of food and the joy of mealtime.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking food and the joy of food and the joy of eating, all of that, and you know, these poor little buggers can't, right?
Right.
That's what we're all about here.
Exactly.
You know? So it's very unusual. Feeding challenges, who might have them? Just about, it could be anybody, right?
It could be. It's actually more common than most would know. There's some data that suggests that up to 80% of children that have autism, that are on the autism spectrum, have some sort of feeding challenge. And then you have children with heart conditions or genetic conditions, other medical conditions that make it either physically difficult to eat, or they have some sort of really, you know, strong wrong sensory issues that keep them from trying different things, which really makes for a very difficult meal times with parents, and you know, something that really shouldn't be enjoyable. So that's where we really feel like this is important, because it does affect so many different different children and families, and a lot of times, like I said, you know, parents don't even know that this is an issue.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So it sort of comes as a surprise when it happens.
Well, you know, I don't understand it, because I'm not a mom from that point of view. But what does feeding therapy involve?
Mm-hmm.
Is it hard to learn?
So, feeding therapy, from my personal perspective, I can give that side of it as a parent, and knowing a little bit about the kind of training that these therapists undergo. Typically, they're either occupational therapists trained or speech therapists, and have an expertise in feeding, which means that they know how to work with different textures, with different approaches to help children become comfortable just even touching food or letting certain kinds of food come near them. There are a lot of babies and children that will, because of their history of eating being painful or being really difficult, may not even want food to come near them. So a lot of times it's a process of, you know, very slow, incrementally working on getting, you know, touching certain things, getting that, you know, being able to, you know, teach a child how to chew, how to use their tongue. I mean, there's a lot of anatomy involved, and coordination, and being able to breathe at the same time, which is, you know, always the priority.
You know, as if there isn't enough stresses, for moms out there and raising children and school and God knows what. Now, what about those then that could do with this help? How can a family apply for a Nourish scholarship?
Right. So the scholarships, as I said, are really open to anyone where there's a need for therapy and there's potential that the insurance won't cover it or will only cover a portion of it. They can go to our website, which is www.nourishaz.org. There's a tab for scholarships, and families can apply there. They can also work with their medical provider to put in an application for a scholarship. And we really don't turn many folks away, if any at all. We really try to fund the need that's there. So
that's excellent.
That's the best way to go about it.
Well, of course, for our listeners, you know, come back to Business Radio X anytime you want. You're going to see all the links, all the social media sites to be able to follow the guys and their various organizations. You'll see photographs of them too, and who we spoke with today, and you'll say, oh, I thought she looked like that. You know, that's one of those things. You never know when they're seeing it. What's going to happen now? I remember last year, I think, Susan, I forget what it was. I walked in the room and out the room, but it was you're on TV. It was during the news, and something had been chopped out or was being changed. I missed the story on it. What's happened since I last interviewed you last year sometime?
So a year ago, CASA's really shifted their work, and part of our shifting from 46 years ago is because we know differently today how to best serve children and families. So as we've shifted our work a lot from less institutional care. So a little over a year ago, we closed our crisis shelter because we were able to take care of those same kids in crisis in the foster care system in homes. We had over 100 licensed foster care homes that were available and a resource for us. So we kind of shifted our work. We just opened in April. We've been building for many years a new family center on our campus. And in January, we're going to open a new early education center for kids' birth to five. So really over the last decade, we've seen CASA just kind of moving the work more upfront, more upstream. How do we work with children and families from the very beginning when they're new parents and kids are young, and you have the ability to have such a better return on investment for those kids by investing in quality home visiting, parent education programs, early education programs.
Right.
That prepare them for life. So what we know about kids being raised in poverty is their life is chaotic at best. I've got a mom and her kid that's living in a tent in Reed Park right now. And guess what they need most?
They
need a cooking device. They have a tent. They need some cooking device.
Right. Just to be
so
able to have
some food. So you just start to look at some of those things, and then you're like, well, how does the focus even start to be about how do I better my parenting when I really am not sure where I'm going to sleep tomorrow night? And so I think we just really want to make sure we can help young families with mm-hmm. young kids early on, because we can prevent so much down the road. We can prevent them from ever coming into our child welfare system, which is not an easy system to ever be a part of, and I don't wish it upon any child or family to have to go through. So we've just kind of really shifted our focus on how do we spend more time with families up front and give every new mom the shot she needs and wants, because mm-hmm. every parent has a baby and wants to do the best they can for that child. Sometimes they just don't have the tools to do it.
No, it's a beautiful name, too. How did it come about? Who was the actual founder way back?
So Sister Kathleen Clark was an emergency room nurse at St. Mary's Hospital.
Okay.
And so what she saw coming through the emergency room is what prompted her to have a crisis shelter, because she saw kids being abused and wanted a safe place for families to put their kids. This was before there was even a child protective service system.
Right.
Put their kids so they could deal with their crisis, whether it was housing or domestic violence, those kind of issues at home, but then when they could parent safely again, they could come pick up their children again. So that's where it started.
Nifty idea, wasn't it?
Many years ago. It's a great idea, and I think now we just know we can do the same work, really more home-based, community-based.
Yeah, well, that's good. And you keep coming up with things all the time. You're going to be there a while, aren't you?
Well, we'll see about that.
Yeah. No. Okay. T, you've got various programs. Could you touch on a few?
Well, I'd like to pick up on what Susie was saying about prevention. I think the home repair is really critical for us right now in Tucson and in Pima County. The age of our residents, a silver tsunami is hitting us, if we like to call it. We have a lot of aging Tucsonans. It's very sexy to see the walls come up on a new house, and it's not as sexy to think about someone's grandmother or grandfather sitting in their home with a leaking roof and an aging swamp cooler that's, dripping down. And that's the reality for so many people. And I'm afraid in my 30-plus years career, I've had to tell more people no, because we don't have the funding to fix those types of problems, because people direct their funds to new sexy houses. And I'm not saying that we don't need those houses, because we do.
Right.
We have so many families, and I'm glad you said that. Well. People living away from their children because they can't afford to shelter them and they can't afford to feed them is a reality. We have families. We had a family 2 years ago, a mother and her daughter living in another family member's garage. It's cold in the winter, and we all know how hot it is in our garage in the summer.
Oh, my word.
And just this past year, we've had a gentleman and his two sons, single dad, raising two elementary age boys in a family member's garage. So new houses are still critical to us.
Mm-hmm.
But, the repair programs are so important. We have generations of Tucsonans. People are living longer. They have their homes. We need to help keep them in it. We'd love to hear from some veterans that they don't ask for help until their house is so far gone that we can't save it.
No.
There's so much need out there. We just need to connect the need with the right service. We love working with our fellow nonprofits. Together, we can come together, work together smartly. And I think there's a lot we can do for our community. And it's Tucsonans have always been generous, and we've always worked together. And I think it's now, as much as any time in our nation, is a time for us to come together, work in the way Habitat was formed, and that is people with different skills, different ideals.
What about pieces of equipment for a home? Lots of things are thrown out by people, right? Still working. Still maybe old, but in good nick.
That's why we have the Habby Store.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. That's what I'm alluring to.
Call the Habby Store. Sure, you have the number. I don't have my glasses on. But call the Habby Store. Come by at 935 West
Grant Road. It's thriving. There's lots of great stuff. I'm to a point where I have to donate two items for everyone I buy because there's so much great stuff there. I was to a Rotary Club, I won't say which one, yesterday morning, and I mentioned the store, and like 10 hands went up. They wanted to tell me what items they had purchased at the store. It's just an amazing, amazing shop, and it's diverting stuff from the landfill.
Right.
So we're doing great at the Habas store.
So we had a great partnership going on because our thrift store is across the street from Habitat's administrative offices. So before they had the Habitat store, we would always divert a lot of appliances that we probably had a harder time selling to them, and then they'd get things like clothing that they might have a hard time selling and divert it back to us.
We still do.
I know we do.
Yeah.
No, we weren't really running across the road with the stuff.
But there's a ton of stuff we don't sell.
That's how partnership, and I think in Pima County is so rich.
We have these big barrels or big rolling, almost like you see at the dry cleaners.
Yep.
And we fill them up, and up comes the Casa de los Niños box truck. Yep. And sometimes you have these big console things you guys cannot sell at your shop. We go through them like that. The guys unload these big consoles, and they roll up toys and skateboards and bicycles, things that are donated to us. We don't sell. Mm-hmm. And off they go. And so,
we're both very unique in that we each have a store. We're not on every corner. We're not, you know, that's not our model.
No.
So people have to work harder to give to us in those areas.
But it's a true partnership. You know, and the other thing other nonprofits need to know, or other people, I think the public doesn't know that we work together. I think they have this sense that we're this big, you know, fighting match of fighting for dollars, but we're not. We truly want people to know we're layering for these families, service on service. You know, they'll come into Susie's place and have some family needs, and she'll be like, but you qualify for a Habitat home, so let me get you over there. And it's really about layering for our community.
Well, you have all sorts of ways for people to become involved.
We do.
Donate, volunteer. The sponsorship at the shop, at the Habit Store, of course.
Absolutely.
And events, and even donate your car. Now, how does that go down?
Cars for Homes. And we are one of the top Cars for Homes car collectors in the United States. So that is huge.
Is there a tax write-off for the donator?
There is.
And donor, I should say.
The donor, they take care of all of that. You just need to call, and we'll take your car. Go to the website, point, click, give. They come and pick up the car. They take care of all the paperwork.
How about that?
That's great.
How about that? So I'm going to ask you now, because you're women in business, you are top echelon roles and role models to young women listening, or to older women listening who maybe want to, you know, get involved or do something and start a business. If not, I want to ask each of you, you know, Jennifer, you're probably the youngest length of time in doing a not-for-profit, but if you look back now at your career in doing all of this, what would you say would be your worst mistake, your worst decision-making mistake in what you've done?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've only been president for a couple of months of the board. Fortunately, I haven't had too much opportunity to make some big mistakes. But I think that a big challenge for us going forward is to navigate some of the funding environment and figure out how we can come up with some creative strategies for that, and find our donors that really are committed to us. So I think that would be something that is going to be a new area for us to really get into and possibly, you know, adjust and adapt a little bit and tweak our mission if we need to. And so I think that's just part of the job. And part of my role as president is sort of leading that charge. And I think that's the direction we're heading.
So. All right. So you learn from it.
Yes.
You learn
always
from
learning.
It big time.
Always
www.nourishaz.org, of course, is the site. Jennifer Shungut.
Correct.
Is the CEO. 2 months, is that it?
As president, yes.
As president? God love you. I mean, you still got, you know, shine on your nose.
Oh, my goodness.
The chief executive officer of Casa de los Niños, Suzy Hune. You have been around long enough to know. You don't make many now, but when you reflect back, was there one?
Yes, I do. I still make mistakes, and I still learn from them. I think if you aren't making mistakes, you're probably not taking enough risk. So I really do believe in risk-taking and really taking a hold of opportunities. And you're going to fail, but you got to fail quickly.
Don't drag it out.
But I think
I'm taking notes here.
Yeah. I think the really biggest thing is really to make sure that you don't allow toxic people to be around you and around on your staff because it just will eat up your culture. And I think culture is critical for keeping people and making sure that people really feel inspired by that.
So
I kept somebody too long.
That's your biggest recommendation. All righty. And T. Van Hook is the CEO for Tucson Habitat for Humanity, a wonderful organization. And thank you again for being with us today. Your biggest mistake when you look back?
Well, I was going to use Susie's, but I will say this. I think the biggest mistake I make daily is not forgiving myself for... You know, we get overloaded as CEO, and so much is expected from us. Everyone that hits our door, it's their number one priority. We have to prioritize everyone else's number one. And I think sometimes I forget to forgive myself for not being perfect all of the time. And I don't know if men are the same, but as women, I think we're very hard on ourselves when we do make those 100 mistakes a day. And so I think that's some advice we would give you as the obviously much younger.
And I think that's the beauty about is networking with other CEOs because you can't have those conversations with your staff.
No,
you cannot.
And so it can be very lonely at the top unless you find
others
outlets to have those conversations.
As women, I think, too, in some type of leadership, when we take on leadership roles, we also have a really hard time giving things up. So we still try to do everything and do everything just right.
You know why? Because women are givers. You do more than men, and you take far more pain than men ever could. So, you know, but thank you, ladies. You're all wonderful. We had a special today, No Glass Ceiling, not-for-profits, darn good causes in our community. And we only had 3 out of the 5,000. What is it? 3,000?
3,000.
We got a lot to go. But no, we had T. Van Hook, of course, and Jenny Schoengert and Suzy Hewen. So we hope you enjoyed the show. It came to you live from the Stewart Title Building on Broadway here in Tucson, Arizona. And if you haven't been out here yet, you should. It's the nice time of the year, blue skies, and we want your money. Come on. You've been listening to No Glass Ceiling with Mark Bishop.